I love how all girls are move them body. And when you move your body, you to move it nice and sweet and sexy. Alright, woman, you're cute. How you doing, you know me? You're not cute, buddy. You want me fun, man? Woman, you're cute. How you doing, you know me? You're not cute, buddy. You want me fun, man? Woman, physically fitter, physically fitter, physically, physically, physically. Woman, physically fitter, physically fitter, physically, physically, physically. Woman, you're nice, sweet, fantastic. Bitch, you're funny, you're not a big guy, and if woman, you're nice, sweet, I ain't got a thing. Bitch, you're funny, you're not a big guy, and if woman, you're nice.
Just about 9 o'clock straight up at 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, where for this next hour programming, opinions and views expressed are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. Good morning, it's Talking Animals.
Oh,
This is music by U2 with a song called Mkadub. My Gaelic isn't as sharp as it should be, but that translates to the Black Cats. And a 25-year-old piece they played opening night of their world tour. San Diego, and again, on night four of the tour, right here in good old Orange County. So, well, you don't typically hear U2 on KCI at this point. What better confluence of circumstances as we ease into today's edition of Talking Animals on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. Streaming live on the internet at KUCI.org. And the whole enterprise is broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. Home, I hasten to add, of the Anteaters. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'll be with you till 10 o'clock this morning with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. Right off the bat, I'd like to tell you that for the next hour, you can reach us directly by phone at 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI, and I absolutely urge you to use that number. I'm telling you, we love to get calls. Give us a call, 949-824-5824. You can also instant message us via AOL Instant Messenger. The screen name is Talking Animals. Other ways to be in touch include emailing us at talkinganimals@AOL.com and checking out our website, talkinganimals.net. Again, that's .net, folks. Also, before I move on, I want to thank Serena Sharp for another peppy, provocative edition of the Serena Sharp Show, and also wish her a very happy 4th anniversary here at good old KUCI. And Mike, don't be shy about coming in, because I'll be blabbing for some time. But meanwhile, here at Talking Animals, primarily we strive to learn about animals and animal issues from our guests, from news items, from your calls, from assorted other sources, but also we're here each week to celebrate animals through music, comedy, and other means. We aim for a spirited balance of those elements, as you can readily glean, by visiting our nifty website, talkinganimals.net, where nearly every show we've ever broadcast is archived there on the site. And clearly the heart of the program is the interview we conduct each week with some notable inhabitant of some province of the animal world. And today, our guest is Chris Chester, author of Providence of a Sparrow, Lessons from a Life, Gone to the Birds, a absolutely gorgeously written, rich, poignant memoir of sorts, anchored to the pivotal events of Chris and his wife rescuing and then living with a house sparrow named Bee. So we'll find out all about this award-winning book. It's now out in paperback about Bee and about the other birds in his life and much, much more when Chris Chester joins us in a few minutes here on Talking Animals. Meanwhile, it's time for our weekly look at items of interest in animal news. And I want to remind you of the phone number to join us on the show with your own comments and questions about animals. Not only this week's animal news items, but also any other animal topic you'd care to discuss. Announcements of upcoming events, observations you have of the animal world, any news stories you might have spotted we should be talking about, all of that and more will be most welcome. Phone number again, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. Turning now to interesting or important developments recently in animal news. Typically these are local, regional, national, sometimes international animal stories of note that seem important to spotlight, and with any luck, maybe, possibly, to get your comments on and discuss. We also try to include a few announcements of upcoming events or activities that you may want to pencil in your calendar. So, having said that, I think you know what's coming next. Talk Turkey, as it were. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department, let's dive right in. This came from CNN.com, from one of our listeners, as a matter of fact. Always appreciate that. Once again, talkinganimals@AOL.com. You can send anything you like, including the news stories. So this one is actually datelined Boise, Idaho, but you'll see it's actually tied into a different location. Starts off, this is from the Associated Press, by the way, by way of CNN.com. All right, I think that's getting confusing, yes. Starts off, it's not easy being a pudgy pachyderm. Everyone, from people for the ethical treatment of animals to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, seems to want to weigh in with opinions on trimming Maggie, the elephant's waistline. Soon Maggie may not need the advice. Keepers at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage, where Maggie lives, are preparing to install an elephant exercise treadmill. Quote, all I know is it seems like a good idea to get a sedentary animal moving, said Sid Cannon, the vice president of Boise, Idaho-based Conveyor Engineering, a company that designs heavy-duty conveyor systems used in mining and has offered to build Maggie's treadmill. I figured that we put rocks on our conveyors that are as big as an elephant, and a treadmill is basically a conveyor, so building one would be no big deal. It has turned out to be not that easy. In the wild, African elephants stay on the move about 16 hours a day, foraging for food and water. But Maggie, like all zoo elephants, is confined and alone. The cold Alaska winters keep her indoors part of the year. That's got some animal advocates pushing to have Maggie retired to a sanctuary or moved to a zoo in a warmer climate. Quote, there's no comparison to a treadmill versus life in the wild or in a sanctuary, said Nicole Meyer, an elephant specialist with PETA. Female elephants are highly social, and to keep them in solitary confinement is completely cruel. John Seawall, who heads up the elephant habitat at the Alaska Zoo, hopes the treadmill will stem some criticism. Quote, you could stand to lose a couple of hundred pounds, but out of a weight of 9,200 pounds, it's somewhat insignificant, he said. Canada first heard about the search to make the elephant treadmill while watching the evening news. He called up Seawall and offered the services of conveyor engineering for free. And the story continues from there. But quite a few issues there, not the least of which, of course, elephants and zoos, which can be done, as we learned when we spoke to Dr. Joel Parrott from the Oakland Zoo very recently. But almost never, never, never should they be kept alone, solitary. And not to mention in the kind of weather that Alaska brings most of the year. But anyway, that's off the topic of Maggie Maysoon having her own treadmill. All right. So, didn't get to this one last week, but this is from the L.A. Times, and it deals with the Los Angeles Zoo, speaking of zoos. And we'll just start off reading it as it is. This is, says, the courtship had an awkward start. She was aloof. He was frustrated. He lunged at her. She backed away. But even in wildlife, there are second chances. A few weeks later, she threw herself at him, and he touched her gently in the confines of a private outdoor enclosure at the Los Angeles Zoo. Minyak and Colleen became the dream couple, two pure Bornean orangutans. They were spotted one day caressing and grooming each other for hours. Quote, it was a pure love fest, said animal keeper Megan Fox. For a week last June, they made it every day. Their coupling would produce one of the zoo's new spring additions and offer testament to the physical prowess of the once sickly and depressed male, Minyak, and the nurturing skills of the unproven Colleen, the female. Long before the birth, zookeepers had to play the roles of matchmaker, therapist, and trainer. Most zoos breed animals to preserve the endangered species. The Species Survival Plan, which accredited zoos treat like a Bible, lays out a genetic roadmap for breeding animals with as much diversity as possible. But it is rarely a matter of locking two animals in the same enclosure. Even then, it can fall for the same mystical reasons that it fails in humans. But I want to skip to alright, because this is kind of the central part of the story that I like. First-time mothers, particularly those raised in captivity, are often clueless with their newborns. Deprived of role models in the wild and sometimes hand-reared by zoo staff, they often ignore their babies, carry them upside down, or injure them. Colleen, raised by zoo staff, was seen as an at-risk mother. So after confirming the pregnancy, mammal curator McNancy decided the zoo had to teach mothering to Colleen. Animal keeper Megan Fox, Kaleem's primary teacher, started by putting a furry brown stuffed orangutan from the zoo gift shop in Kaleem's enclosure. Quote, it's just natural for them to pick something like that up, Fox said. When Kaleem picked up the stuffed toy, she was rewarded with a snack. Once she knew that the whole training thing was based on the stuffed animal, it was easier for her. Eager to please, Kaleem would then try to give the toy animal to her keeper. They like trading for stuff. I had to be careful not to reward her for trying to stuff the baby through the mesh, Fox said. Et cetera, et cetera. But anyways, basically, so that's how they trained Colleen, or at least in the early stages, to care for her baby, Barani. So, there you go. This comes from the OCPA. It's part of their newsletter. It's the Orange County People for Animals. And their website is actually OCPAUSA.org if you want to find out more about them or more information than what we're going to be reading to here. But a couple of quick items I thought bared mentioning. Connecticut considers ban on traveling elephant exhibits. A bill was recently introduced in Connecticut that would prohibit the use of elephants for entertainment purposes by traveling shows, theatrical exhibition, and circuses. So that's always a step in the right direction. We'll keep you posted on that. Moving in an entirely different part of the country, cockfighting ban passes in New Mexico. House Bill 878 to ban cockfighting in New Mexico passed with a 50-15 vote without debate or the presence of cockfighting proponents. And then, moving far afield, from the U.S. even, Tel Aviv bans animal circus acts. The municipality of Tel Aviv banned animal circus acts and will avoid any future contracts with circuses that use animals in any sort of their shows. The great achievements was a result of an anonymous for animal rights campaign that incorporated public campaign and political lobby. Hopefully other cities in Israel and abroad will follow Tel Aviv's humane and enlightened decision. Again, those items are from the OCPA e-alert, March 2005. Again, their website, OCPA USA. It's Orange County People for Animals. Time now for our mid-news quiz question. I believe you know how this works, but let's quickly review. It'll be a true-false question once again this week. If you correctly answer and you are the first to do so, then you'll get your choice of a number of prizes, ranging from the DVD of Triumph the Insult Comic Dog to a copy of the book by today's guest, Chris Chester. The name of the book, again, is Providence of a Sparrow, Lessons from a Life Gone to the Birds, and as we'll learn when he joins us shortly here on Talking Animals, it's a really a great, fabulous book. If you don't even think of yourself as a bird person, but you can think of yourself as a book person, at least, or a great writing person, I mean, it's fabulous on that level, and then on a number of other levels, and it's really rich. It's about a number of other things besides the house sparrow that he and his wife rescue and take in, and it goes in all kinds of cool directions from there. Anyways, highly recommended. It's actually award-winning and gotten some great reviews, and it's now in paperback. So that's one of the other prizes you could have. What else? Other books include Meatless Meals for Working People, Shirley MacLaine's book, Out on a Leash, which I delight almost each week in pointing out was co-written by her dog, which is one of the reasons it would be a prize for a Talking Animals quiz. And we've got dog leashes, dog collars, cat toys, T-shirts from other organizations, etc., etc. So, anyways, you will have your choice of those if you're the first person to call in with the correct answer to this quiz question. And keep that in mind for later when we play Name That Animal Tune towards the end of the show, because you would also have your choice of those prizes if you're the first caller with the correct answer there. All right, having over-explained all that, let's dive right in. This is a true-false question. Again, the first person to call 949-824-5824. Would have their choice of those prizes. All right, here we go. A robin, and we sort of a bird or anything with a nod to Chris Chester, our guest coming up. A robin has almost 3,000 feathers. True or false? 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. And for those who suffer allergies to cats and other things, I thought this was pretty interesting. This is from Reuters. A new chemical compound, part cat and part human, may provide an end to misery-making cat allergies, U.S. researchers reported this week in the journal Nature Medicine. They said their approach in creating the compound might work against more dangerous allergies, such as deadly reactions to peanuts. The compound, tested in mice bred to be allergic to cats, virtually shut down the histamine reaction that caused the uncomfortable symptoms of cat allergies, such as runny eyes, sneezing, and itching. Dr. Andrew Saxon of UCLA and his colleagues reported, quote, this novel approach to treating cat allergies is encouraging news for millions of cat allergic Americans, said Dr. Anthony Fossey, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which paid for the study. Moreover, these results provide proof of concept for using this approach to develop therapies to prevent deadly food allergies, allergic reactions as well. So, they're working on it. It's getting there. And, let's see, what else? I think we might have time for another news item or two. This is headline, Animal Laughs No Joke, says expert. Professor Jack Panskip says that animals other than humans exhibit play sounds that resemble human laughs. These include the panting sounds made by chimps and dogs when they play and chirping sounds observed in rats. This suggests that the capacity for laughter may be a very ancient emotional response that predates the evolution of humankind, says Panskip. Research suggests the capacity for human laughter preceded the capacity for speech. And if you are calling in with the answer to a quiz question, hang tight, we'll get to you. We're just sort of switching over a little phone system, so I can't actually answer it right this minute. But it's not a scam. If you know the answer, we'll get you on the show at some point, and we'll get you your prize if you are the correct calling with the correct answer. All right. So, continuing with this item, research Professor Pansky at the Bowling Green University in Ohio explains that neural circuits for laughter exist in ancient parts of our brain, whose general structure is shared amongst many animals. Young chimps, quote, play pant as they mischievously chase and tickle each other. And when rats play, they make chirps, which some scientists associate with positive emotional feelings. When rats are tickled in a playful way, they become socially bonded to humans and are rapidly conditioned to seek tickles, the U.S. neuroscientist explains in Science magazine. The chirping sounds could be provoked by nerve circuitry in the brain, which releases the neurotransmitter dopamine. These dopamine circuits also light up in the human brain during human amusement. Quote, such knowledge may help to reveal how joking and horsing around emerge in our expansive higher brain regions, Professor Pansky writes. Although no one has investigated the possibility of rat humor, if it exists, it is likely to be heavily laced with slapstick. Ah, come on, they gotta like that, right? Rat humor? If they have it at all, it's slapstick? How do they know? I like it. All right. All right, continuing, I actually pulled this from the journalistic giant People magazine a couple weeks ago, but hey, we take them where they come. It's headline, Nearer to God Than Flea. A church opens its doors to all God's creatures, great and small. Starts off the congregation at the 4 p.m. Sunday service at St. Francis Episcopal Church in Stamford, Connecticut, is a well-behaved one. No heavy panting during the homily, no claws clicking across the wooden floor between readings. And if the solemnity is occasionally broken by an unprompted chorus of yowling, yapping, and barking, oh, don't be worried by that, says Reverend Richard E. Mayberry. This is how they pray. They're making a joyful noise. That's because at the increasingly popular monthly mass, parishioners present unto the Lord not just their souls, but their pets. On a recent Sunday, the congregation of 20-odd four-legged attendees include two golden retrievers, a husky with a pink bow in her fur, and a cat, Riley, clinging in terror to her 9-year-old owner, Anson Mercero. At the altar, Reverend Mark Lingle cradles his West Highland Terrier, Wesley, as he reads from a prayer book, remembering at this time, our pets, pray for pets. Amen. The service held on the third Sunday of each month evolved over the past few years after parishioner Lillian Kramer, a retired corporate bankruptcy lawyer, first brought her dog Grantham to church. When more pets began popping up at services, the special mass was born. Quote, I think if there is anything like godly love, it's the love between people and their dogs, said Kramer. And even if a pet isn't, shall we say, church-broken, the three critter-loving ministers who run St. Francis are always forgiving. Quote, we have a hardwood floor, says Mabry laughing. We can clean it up. Huh? How about that, folks? All right, and lastly, I want to talk again about the animal rescue site, which we've mentioned periodically on the show from almost the day we started talking animals. This is a website. The address is the Animal Rescue Site. It's the Animal Rescue Site, SITE.com. And you can go there every day, and in fact, we're urging you to go there every day. And when you get there, you just click on a section that says feed an animal in need. And what that does through an arrangement with corporate sponsors and advertisers is that frees up money to indeed feed that animal or care for that animal, as case may be, at a shelter, an abandoned, neglected animals, etc. So you can go, like I say, every day, and we urge you to do that. And it's the animalrescuesite.com. So that, I think, is going to do it for this edition of the Animal News. And, of course, if there are any news stories or announcements, events that you'd like to bring to our attention, please feel free to email us those items at talkinganimals@aol.com. We'd also love to encourage you to email us with any comments about the show, suggestions of future guests, ideas about animal songs, animal comedy bits, any other animal topic that's on your mind. That email, again, is talkinganimals@aol.com. And I'm pleased to remind you that we'd love to have you visit our website. It's talkinganimals.net. Again, it's .net. And sign up for the email list so we can keep you posted on upcoming guests and other announcements. You'll also find archives and synopses of all the shows we've done, assorted photographs and articles, all kinds of links, other audio pieces and more. So please stop by and take a look around. The site, again, it's talkinganimals.net. It's time now to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which, as always, of course, involves animal-oriented comedy. It's also a bit more poignant and sad this week because we're going to feature one of our favorites, Mitch Hedberg, who died last week at 37. Mitch was one of the four or five best young stand-up comedians of the last several years. A very sweet man and a supremely gentle soul. Rest in peace, Mitch. This is a brief snippet of his piece called Koalas, on today's Comedy Corner here on KUCI.
My apartment is infested with koala bears. It's the cutest infestation ever. Way better than cockroaches. When I turn on the light, a bunch of koala bears scatter. And I don't want them to, you know? I'm like, hey, hold on, fellas. Let me hold one of you. And feed you a leaf. Why the koala bears?
All right, that was the late, great Mitch Hedberg. Just a brief snippet, just as a little nod to his sad and unfortunate passing last week. That was taken from his Strategic Grill location. And the Comedy Corner, of course, one of the signature features of Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're indeed listening to Talking Animals on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of California at Irvine. Many of you know we also stream live on the internet at KUCI.org. Some of you, no doubt, are listening that very way, and some of you perhaps arrived to our show website, TalkingAnimals.net. Before we proceed, I'm obliged to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in Talking Animals are not necessarily those of KUCI, UC Irvine, or the University of California Board of Regents. All right, well, we'll get today's guest, Chris Chester, on the phone with us. This is as good a time as any to hear an animal tune. This is an instrumental piece by Adrian Legg called Cuckoo Shuffle on Talking Animals here on KUCI. We'll be right back with Chris Chester. This is Adrian Legg with a piece called Cuckoo Shuffle here on KUCI. Early in the show, I mentioned this week's guest is Chris Chester, author of Providence of a Sparrow, Lessons from a Life Gone to the Birds, an absolutely gorgeously written, just rich, poignant memoir of sorts, anchored to the pivotal sort of life-changing event of Chris and his wife rescuing and then living with a house sparrow named Bee. But there's a good deal more to the book, now out in paperback, and to Chris's story than that. So let's not waste any more time. Let's dive in as we welcome Chris Chester to Talking Animals. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals. And I just want to let people know a couple quick things before we start. When the book was named a winner of the 2003 Oregon Book Award for Creative Nonfiction, the accompanying citation from the judge said the book was a staggeringly wholly unmawkish album of mingled lives as if Charles Darwin were presiding over Noah's Ark. And the LA Times called the book a wonderfully literate oddball meditation on life and the power of rich friendships with small birds. So, and there's plenty more raves where those came from, as well there should be. But Chris, now that the book's been out in a while, actually, in paperback, much less in hardback, much less when you wrote it, I thought an interesting way for us to begin would be to ask, to you describe the book now. I mean, especially to what extent has it become something different, maybe, from the creation you typed the final period of, the final draft of, before sending it into off into the world some years ago?
Well, yes. I mean, it certainly had an impact on my life in several ways. One, I've met many fascinating people who had read the book and contacted me, and I've established some marvelous friendships based on that, including one with Bob Tart, who I believe you had on not too long ago, the author of Enslaved by Ducks.
Absolutely, yeah. He tipped me off to your cool book, and that was one of the hottest tips we've gotten here at Talking Animals, for sure. Yeah.
Wonderful fellow.
Yeah.
And a delightful book he's written. Also, once the book came out, I started getting calls from people. They would find my phone number, and they would call me every time they found a baby bird.
Sure. No doubt you've become the Birdman of Portland, right?
Yes. And so we actually, there are several birds living with us now that found their way to us because someone had brought them to us, and they're unreleasable because of an injury or a deformity of some kind, and so they're now living with us.
Sure. But I guess also, too, what I'm curious about as well is to what extent, if any, maybe, the book seems or feels different now with some of those ensuing experiences and just the passage of time and some of the other experiences you've had. I mean, has it changed in any way? Has your perspective on it changed? Or
I think, yes, and the most profound way that has happened is, you know, the central sparrow in the book was the first one that we found. His name was Bee.
Yeah.
And Bee died shortly before Thanksgiving in 2002, which was just a couple of months after the hardback was released. And since then, I've really come to view the book as a testament to his life.
Mm-hmm.
And I only wish that I could have done it better. And I suppose all authors at some point feel that something they've written could have been better.
Oh yeah, really? Yeah. I mean, I know that's not an uncommon lament, but I mean, in the case of Providence of a Sparrow, I mean, what would be one or two things that really, you know, if you could kind of go back and rewrite or redo anything in particular? Or?
I think I would have tried to stress even more than I did how remarkably intelligent and affectionate Bee was, and
mm-hmm.
how absolutely fascinated he seemed to be with people, and how much he wanted to interact with them. And because it, you know, sparrows are, house sparrows, especially in this country, are considered sort of, well, by many people, they're considered pests, nuisances, and as sort of throwaway animals, you might say. And I want people to know that even though there are some problems certainly associated with any time you introduce a non-native species into a place they really didn't evolve in, that you can expect some problems. But nevertheless, having said that, they still are remarkable creatures.
Well, I want to get you know, way more into that and just some of the, you know, some aspects of the unfolding relationship with Bee in a moment, Chris. But let's figuring that many of our listeners probably you know, haven't yet at least had an opportunity to read the book. Hopefully, well, after today. But let's kind of set the scene. Take us back to the time before Bee entered the picture. What was your life like then? What were you doing? How did you spend your time?
Well, I was just my wife and I guess you would say we were just sort of wage slaves. We both worked full time, and I mean, we certainly had interests and activities that we pursued. My wife is an accomplished belly dancer, for one thing. I love to read and spend every free moment that I can diving into a book.
Sure.
And so we, you know, we were just sort of plodding along, a happily married couple, and with three cats in the house, and then one. one day this creature shows up in the yard and changes everything.
Yeah,
you might say.
And really, I mean, because you know, all things considered, and including the life that you've sort of just described that you're leading, and you weren't in any measurable sense a bird guy, and in fact, as you mentioned, there were cats living there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, in reading the book and thinking about it afterwards, have you found yourself pondering whether you were, I don't know, without getting too mystical here, somehow chosen for the task of rescuing B, like if he landed there, you know, literally and figuratively in some significant way, and just all the attendant life changes that are brought to you and Rebecca? I mean, was that, you know, the hands of fate, if not B himself, sort of just selecting you somehow?
Well, I certainly have felt that way sometimes,
yeah,
because it, you know, the changes that he wrought have just been so profound.
Yeah.
And it really does sometimes feel like we were in some sense singled out to do this thing. And as you said, I had really no experience with birds, and so just that whole learning process was a revelation, and that sort of happened along with Bee growing and thriving and starting to emerge as a distinct personality. And so you might say, while I'm at one time trying to educate myself about birds and their needs, I have this living example to sort of guide me through it.
Sure.
And so it was a wonderful time.
Yeah, because I mean, it seems like too, and as the book unfolds and other birds in the picture, which we'll hopefully touch on momentarily here. But I mean, you know, back to the sort of thing of, was it really serendipitous or not? I mean, you know, you can't help but wondering, for example, if instead of meeting B first, or maybe even at all, you know, one of those other birds, you know, you'd rescued for some reason one of those other birds. I mean, you just wonder, you know, how different that might have been. It just seems like B was just so extraordinary in so many ways that it really did spin you off on a path that, you know, even have been another house sparrow or even one of the other ones that ended up living there. You just
mm-hmm.
wonder if it just would have been still kind of cool and neat, but not, you know, opening the whole world for you the way the B did.
Yes, I've wondered that too. And
yeah.
He was such a strong personality. And as I began to feel that about him, I also started to wonder, well, am I imagining this? Am I projecting this? But so many people would come and visit, and I would typically at some point leave the room so that they can have a little alone time with him, and they all would come out of there saying, he's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
He's just really incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, this tiny little bird, you know, filling a room essentially with a force of personality.
And what struck those people visiting and you obviously along the way, I mean, as being so incredible? What made B so special?
Well, one of the most remarkable things, I think, was how playful he was.
Mm-hmm.
He had a whole host of games that he liked to play, one of which was what we call fetch the bottle cap,
right.
Little plastic bottle caps such as you'd find on a milk jug. And he would, you know, literally retrieve them and bring them back. And if you didn't throw it right away, again, he would become very impatient. And he would, if you weren't in the room and he wanted to play, he would invent his own games. He'd fly the cap up to a height and then drop it and chase it. And, you know, that was another, I think, also indication of his intelligence, you know, a creature that was willing to recreate, to play.
Sure.
And
there was a lot of play there. I mean,
lots
it seems
of
like,
play.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
And you know, it seems like, well, actually, let me just tell our listeners, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Chris Chester, author of Providence of a Sparrow, Lessons from a Life Gone to the Birds, a really wonderful memoir about rescuing and living with the bird we're now talking about, named Bee, but it's about a lot more. Unfortunately, today, we're having a little bit of phone trouble, so you can't, otherwise, here would be where I would invite you to call in and ask a question or join the conversation, but sadly we're not able to do that today. But again, going to continue with Chris Chester here. And so Chris, I mean, you know, so people, you know, would visit, they would get to see kind of at least a slice of what Bee made, you know, what made Bee special.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yet, you know, I guess there's probably some people who might be listening to say, well, geez, you know, it sounds cool, but it's still a wild bird at the end of the day. you know, can we just sort of talk about the notion of keeping what are effectively wild birds in your home after they've been rescued and rehabilitated? Because, again, some would say, hey, you know, after you've nursed them back to health, you must release them. And you guys clearly, as bees starts to rally in those initial period after being rescued, there's a lot of struggle that you guys kind of have with that very issue. And you know, you and your wife, Rebecca, each have kind of differing views, which, you know, so maybe you could talk a little bit about that and then kind of where you ended up on that.
Certainly. Well, as you point out, I mean, it really, it kind of the right thing to do whenever possible is if you find a wild creature and you nurse it back to health, whether it's an injured adult or a baby that you provide for until it's able to fend for itself, you know, there's almost like an ethical imperative that you should release it, and that's something that I agree with. And clearly, you know, when we found Bee, and after it became evident that he was probably going to survive, we really did feel that is what we would do. Now, I admit in the book that I was just fascinated with him, and I felt this incredible affinity with him. Whereas my wife, not quite. It took her much longer to really make that connection with Bee, and so she was much more strongly in favor of releasing him as soon as possible. Also bear in mind that at that point we really had no experience with birds. And so by the time that he had fledged and was flying well and would have been releasable, he had bonded so much with me that I felt that on balance he would be happier staying with us. Now, I've since learned that you can do what is called a soft release, and that is, you know, you would perhaps open a window and allow the bird to come and go and sort of make his or her decision that way.
Huh, interesting.
Coming back and finally just don't want to go out anymore, then you can say, well, they've made this very definite choice that they want to remain in the house with
you.
Interesting.
So you really give them that option.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So, but really, in terms of Bee and what you knew then, and again, you were just sort of learning as you went. Mm-hmm. So once it became clear you weren't going to release Bee, you sort of also made a corresponding decision that you know, at the same time, he certainly wasn't going to be holed up in a little cage.
Yeah.
So maybe you could talk with us about the conversion of the bedroom or bedrooms ultimately to an aviary.
Well, once it became evident that he was going to remain, we made the decision that we couldn't possibly bear to cage him. And so if we weren't going to cage him, that meant he had to have a room. And so we ultimately ended up giving him quite a large bedroom at the front of the house. That became Bee's room, and I still refer to it, and probably always shall, as Bee's room.
Sure.
And like I say, I couldn't bear to cage him, and I've really come to feel that caging any bird under most circumstances is probably a very cruel thing to do.
Sure.
And from that point, things just continued to evolve. People brought us additional birds. The second bird was a fledgling that had a deformed foot, and was unreleasable. And then, you know, subsequently we got more birds. We acquired some finches, pet store finches, to keep Bee company, and it just sort of rather snowballed to the point where the whole upstairs really became an aviary with all these birds free flying.
And what is the current bird count now, Chris?
17.
Wow. All right. Now, what's the current cat count?
Two.
Okay, and has that twain never met? I mean, that's almost a remarkable sub-story here, I think.
Yes, they have never met.
Wow.
And, the cats have lost interest, really, in even pursuing it, I think.
Interesting.
Because, you know, after all these years of frustration,
right,
not being able to get upstairs, and I installed a number of screen doors to prevent the birds from going down, or for the cats from getting up.
Yeah,
and that system has worked really pretty well.
That's great. And at the same time, if there's 17 birds, and as you certainly point out in the book, that friends and family and, you know, people like me and others, I guess, you know, inevitably have questions and concerns as they're flying freely about the bathroom habits and output, and you also kind of seem, you know, simultaneously bemused by people who inquire about this using euphemisms of plenty when they otherwise might be people who, you know, swear like a sailor or whatever. But thanks to the FCC and other station policy, I mean, we're stuck here with euphemisms. So talk to us a little bit about the poop and pee with that many birds and flying around bedrooms, basically, and how that works.
Well, it's, as you can imagine, and as I'm sure listeners can imagine, it's there's a lot of debris.
Yeah.
Debris,
that's another cool euphemism.
A lot of debris.
Debris.
Yes. But, you know, it's sort of like anything else that you become used to over time. Repulsive aspect you may have found in it to begin with, it just sort of vanishes. It becomes another element, like air, I guess you'd say. And, you know, the sparrow poop is really pretty manageable. It's small, and you can find it anywhere, but they have different spots that it tends to show up in en masse, you might say.
I see.
And but, you know, obviously there's a lot of cleaning that goes on here. Daily maintenance that has to be performed to keep us from, you know, just sinking under the weight of not only the poop, but just, you know, the food debris and so on, that, you know, steed casings and whatever else you might find. And so it's a lot of work.
Yeah, but I assume also by now you guys have probably devised a pretty efficient system to at least keep up with it, if not stay ahead of it. So, I mean, this is a good, you know, what, 10, 12 years or so that you've been...
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So...
yeah.
And, you know, well, again, a great deal of the action, you know, in the book pivots on your life and deepening the relationship with B. I mean, you know, this is an account with more than a little heft and some very, you know, serious subject matter beyond that. I mean, you know, some family issues, you know, a whole chapter and beyond about loss. And at one point deep in, you know, kind of your pretty nakedly, you know, stated fear of B's death. And then, you know, after you get through that, you know, then you hit this epilogue, only to learn that, you know, sort of the heart-wrenching news that B has passed away indeed. So, I mean, it's, I don't know if there were... Was it always that kind of rich and powerful, or you know, I don't know how many drafts there might have been, but I mean, it just, you know, I mean, because it sells it short to just say, hey, it's about a guy who rescues a house sparrow and his wife takes him in, you know, I mean, it's so much more than that. And did it evolve into more than that, or was it always kind of pretty hefty in that way from the get-go?
Well, I had when I made a firm decision and commitment to myself to write this book, I came up with an outline, and I had it pretty much set, the topics that I wanted to cover, and I had made some fairly extensive notes about B's behavior in particular, and so when I set out to write, I had at least that kind of a roadmap in front of me to follow, and it more or less turned out the way I had planned it. Now, when the hardback was published, B was still alive.
Yeah,
and it was about two months after that he died.
Mm-hmm.
And then subsequently, the you know, the Random House purchased paperback rights, and so this, you know, second edition was coming out in paperback. And my agent asked me if I had any interest in writing an epilogue, and I did not, and that was
just because it was too hard, kind of.
Hard.
Yeah,
I was just devastated.
Yeah.
And but a couple of months passed, and one day I woke up and I just felt kind of this compulsion to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote the epilogue, and it was then included in the paperback release.
Sure. Again, I want to tell people we're talking with Chris Chester, author of Providence of a Sparrow, Lessons from a Life Gone to the Birds. It's out on paperback, a fabulous, fabulous book. And unfortunately today we're not able to take listener calls. But Chris, so, you know, yeah, I just feel like maybe we should even hit a bit more about B. I mean, you know, that just the sense of friendship and the sense of tranquility that you convey so much, where you know, you sort of go in and you guys are just hanging, and sometimes he's just, you know, next to you or in your palm.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, you know, a few times in the book you talk about sort of the, you know, the tricky or downside, whatever, of, you know, sort of
anthropomorphizing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. And yet, you know, there's almost no way to not when it came to this bird, because he just seemed like he had such an incredibly complex personality, and just, and also some of the great writing, too. I remember there was something going on, and he talked about sort of getting, you know, impatient. Finally, he was like, coming out to investigate the delay, and you could actually really picture this little bird, like, impatient, like, hey, what's the hold up here? Where's my food or where's my whatever, you know? And
yep.
So you really, I mean, you really capture that. But what would you say, I mean, was the kind of the most, I don't know, rewarding or fulfilling aspect of that very singular friendship with this bird?
Well, I would have to say that probably first and foremost was the, you know, the realization that I had fairly early on. But it was one that that deepened as time passed, was the idea that I really, truly felt that B was a conscious being with an inner life. And, you know, I have no idea how consciousness feels to another creature. I'm sure in significant ways it's different from how it feels to us, but nevertheless, the bottom line is I think he had an inner life and a sense of self and an identity,
mm-hmm.
as real to him as mine is to me. And so being able to interact with this other life form and really feel that there was a conscious connection between us,
yeah,
was just a remarkable thing.
And Chris, I mean, with the, you know, the 17 birds of various stripes that live there now, I mean, has there been any kind of other bird that had, you know, even a remotely as profound an impact, or was B indeed really just kind of a singular creature in that way?
Well, B was certainly extraordinary, and because he was, you know, the first,
sure,
one, the one that I bonded most closely with,
yeah,
I knew him the best, and
yeah,
I spent the most time with him. But, you know, the other sparrows, indeed the other birds in general, are all remarkable in their own way. And,
yeah.
But just touching on the sparrows, we currently have six. And, you know, Bad Baby, who was the second sparrow,
yeah,
that came to us, he is still with us. He's almost, he'll be eight in August.
Wow. Yeah.
And he's doing well, and he's distinct as well. I mean,
mm-hmm,
he has his quirks and his likes and dislikes,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, very strong sense of personality about him as well.
That's cool. And again, I guess, you know, we should really make clear, if it's hopefully not already, that, you know, even if you're not particularly a bird person, I don't think of yourself as a bird person, coming to the book, I mean, it's pretty hard not to read it and then, you know, sort of be more of one, or be more open to being one, or just be more fascinated by birds. I mean, you really sort of, you know, you take us into a world that, again, if, you know, if you're not really bird-oriented, you think, wow, you know, I've been missing a lot here. I mean, and not just the birds that you think of when people have birds at home. I mean, these are, you know, wild birds and house sparrows and things that you don't even think of. But you think, boy, I've been missing a lot here, you know?
Yeah.
So, I guess we're just sort of about nearing the end of our time here, Chris. But I hope and assume there's another book in the works.
Yes, I'm working on a second book now. It's not related to birds, however.
Okay.
It's about belly dance.
Well, that's
a departure.
Yeah, no, but and you touched on this very briefly, but maybe you could tell a bit more to our listeners about, you know, probably how you came to that topic in particular.
Well, my as I mentioned in Providence, my wife is a belly dancer. She's been dancing now since 1989, and is quite accomplished, and it's a big part of her life. And because of my relationship with her, I've come to find out that in this country, belly dance is really a distinct subculture, and it's fascinating. Its history is fascinating. The people involved in it are fascinating, and it's just sort of a whole interesting way of life that I think is an interesting topic for a book, and so I'm trying to talk about that.
That's great, because, I mean, you do acknowledge in Providence that, you know, I mean, she's got a great passion for it, but otherwise sort of the world of belly dancing and the interest, or at least demand for it in restaurants and other places, has kind of diminished over time, but but maybe you'll help breathe new life into the forum, at least in this country.
So, yeah, well, there's been a bit of a resurgence, oddly enough, after 9/11.
Oh, interesting.
There was an uptick in interest, and it's sort of burgeoning right now.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Wow, so you're right on track. This
I'm on
perfect.
Track, yeah.
Cool. All right, Chris, well, we just about are out of time, but again, I want to thank you for joining us today on Talk Animals. I want to let listeners know one last time, the name of the book is Providence of a Sparrow, Lessons from a Life Gone to the Birds. It's out on paperback. Could not recommend it more highly. Chris Chester, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and good luck with all your birds and cats and Rebecca and everyone else there.
Duncan, thank you very much. My pleasure being with you.
All right, thanks so much. All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
All right, that was Chris Chester. Again, please, if you have a chance, check out that book. It's really, really just so well done, and as I think we hopefully covered, so much more than just about house sparrows, although certainly a lot about that, but this bird bee is really incredible. So it's time now for Name That Animal Tune on KUCI. It's like any other version of Name That Tune you care to mention, except in this game, the tunes are always animal-related. So I'm playing a little snippet here. There'll be a prize, which we'll have to do by email, since we're a little out of the phone game today. But if you recognize this animal tune, and the first to do so, an email to talkinganimals@AOL.com, then you'll get your choice of all those prizes we mentioned earlier in the show.
The things you wanted, I bought them for you. Graceless lady, you know who I am. You know I can't let you slide through my hands.
All right, well, when we officially give away the song title by way of the song itself, I think that's plenty, isn't it? All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. We have just about reached the end of this week's edition of Talking Animals. I want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed in the show are not necessarily those of KUCI, UCI, or the University of California Board of Regents. I want to again thank our guest, Chris Chester. One more time, the book is Providence of a Sparrow, Lessons from a Life Gone to the Birds. And I hope you'll join us next Monday, April 11th, when our likely guest will be Philip Jenny, Executive Director of the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Minnesota, which provides medical care for injured, ill, and orphaned wildlife, treating about 8,000 patients, if you will, each year. By the way, other great public affairs shows on KUCI include, just today alone, the Serena Sharp Show, which of course precedes Talking Animals. Then at 5 p.m., we'll offer Counterspin, followed at 5:30 by Planetary Radio with Matt Kaplan, and that's just Monday. There's great public affairs programming and talk shows like this each weekday, 8 to 9 to 9 to 10 in the morning, then again from 5 to 6 in the afternoon. And again, I want to urge you to check out our website, talkinganimals.net. When you get there, please sign up for our email list so we can alert you to guest bookings and other events and announcements. Also, I encourage you to email me with comments, guest suggestions, ideas about show topics, songs, comedy bits, news stories, and anything else you'd like to pass along at talkinganimals@AOL.com. I really look forward to hearing from you. Come on, seriously, I really do. Please stay tuned for Jeff Scott and the Blues Disease. This is great, great, great blues show here coming up on KUCI momentarily. This has been Talking Animals on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks very much to Mike Boyle for scrambling to get us at least the phone line to speak to Chris Chester, which saved the show. Very much appreciated. So everyone have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And as always, we're closing things out here with an animal-related tune. That's yet another sort of final nod to Chris Chester and his book. This is Charlie Parker with Chasing the Bird on KUCI. We'll catch you next week on Talking Animals. ¶¶